Hey, yo, what is a cypher?
A little bit of Prince and a little bit of Michael, a little bit of James, a little bit of Rick.
You. The knowledge of the cypher is to enlighten you.
Where you think the cypher come from?
The gods.
Because you tried to jump the cypher and it goes this way.
Welcome to The Cypher, a weekly podcast bringing you talks with the most interesting figures in hip-hop and culture. I'm your host, Sean Sotero. This is episode 212, a talk with Bobby Brown. Bobby, as you likely already know, has been a trendsetter in popular music from the beginning of his career in the 1980s with New Edition. While he had plenty of memorable hits with the group, it wasn't until his second solo album, 1988's Don't Be Cruel, that he exploded as a superstar. That album, which contained epic hits like the title track, Roni, Every Little Step, and of course My Prerogative, was the best-selling album in the US in 1989, and would go on to sell over 7 million copies. Since then, Bobby has continued to have hit songs, be on reality TV, write a memoir, and maybe run into a controversy or two that you might have heard about. But now he's back to his first love, performing. We spoke to Bobby Brown right before his recent appearance at Rochester's Music Fest. Bobby's got a crazy travel schedule right now, so we caught up with him by phone right before he had to head off to the airport. It's not our longest or most hi-fi episode, but we guarantee you'll take something away from this one you didn't know. By the way, since there's plenty of interviews that hit on some of the more salacious aspects of his family life, we didn't feel like wasting his or your limited time with that. If you like the show, please check out our Patreon at patreon.com/thecyphershow. Every new patron helps make sure Josh won't be on his own against Vigo, and we've recently updated our rewards with some great new stuff. If you want to know any of the songs we're playing during this episode, visit thecyphershow.com to find a complete list and the show notes. While you're there, sign up for our monthly newsletter to stay on top of what's going on with The Cypher. And now, here's a man who taught millions of DJs and music fans how to spell prerogative, Bobby Brown. Very happy to have a special guest on the show here, B Flash.
Well, my friends call me Flash B, and it's the kind of girl that's just for me.
Sean got this backwards, and it's obviously Flash B.
Flash B is my name. King of stage is my fame. I'm entertaining on the mic, known to be like my...
Flash B.
Yeah, so that was your name for quite a while. I think you even used that into your solo career on and off. Where did that come from? Was that from Grandmaster Flash?
Yeah, that was back in my days when I really idolized Grandmaster Flash, you know, in the Furious Five. That's when I really was, you know, into hip-hop, you know, in early years before everybody else was. But yeah, that was my name. And also because I was really quick. I was really quick as a dancer. And, you know, Flash B just stuck with me, you know, throughout the projects and, you know, everything I was doing. But yeah, that was my name.
So I know that, actually, speaking of Flash, Scorpio was from Grandmaster Flash was your favorite song to dance to back then. What was your sort of go-to killer move to that song?
There was a few. I had a few moves that was just, you know, that was super. And plus, I was the first one in Orchard Park to do the moonwalk.
By Orchard Park, Bobby means Roxbury's now-demolished Orchard Park Projects, which came to be known as the home of New Edition after the group found success.
So the moonwalk was one of my signature moves. And, you know, I had brought it up from down south. And it was just something that, you know, just killed the game once I brought it up the East Coast.
And that was before Motown 25?
Oh. Yeah, way before that. actually, I was the one that taught Michael how to do it.
The King of Pop, Michael Jackson, made the moonwalk famous at the Motown 25 celebration on March 25, 1983. However, this was far from the first time it was performed. The use of similar dance moves are reported as early as 1932, when Cab Calloway did what he would later call the buzz. In 1944, Judy Garland did something similar in the film Meet Me in St. Louis while singing Under the Bamboo Tree. Famous French mime Marcel Marceau used it throughout his career, in particular in his famed Walking Against the Wind routine, something Dick Van Dyke also did in the 1950s in his comedy routine. In 1955, tap dancer Bill Bailey used it in a routine, and then none other than Bob Fosse used the moonwalk in his role as a snake in the 1974 film The Little Prince. James Brown, of course, also used the move along with the camel walk, and you can even see him do it in the 1980 movie The Blues Brothers. In 1982, Debbie Allen performed a moonwalk during a scene in the TV series Fame. In Flashdance, the move was used in the B-Boys scene, where the Rocksteady Crew's Mr. Freeze does the move. Mr. Freeze's version also was shown in the first hip-hop movie, Wild Style, and the Malcolm McLaren video, Buffalo Gals. For more on the Rocksteady Crew, also check out our upcoming episode with their president, Richard Crazy Legs Colon. In addition to Bobby's account here, there are several other stories about how Michael Jackson may have learned the dance. On page 210 of his 1988 autobiography, Moonwalk, Jackson said that, quote, three kids taught it to him, implying that he learned it on the street. However, Jeffrey Daniel of the group Shalimar had been doing the dance on UK's Top of the Pops in the early 80s, as well as on Soul Train as far back as 1974, and many have suggested that Jackson learned the move from him. Jackson's sister LaToya has publicly agreed with this origin story. Another possible source were Cooley Jackson and Casper Candidate, who also did the dance on Soul Train, and have said that Jackson later contacted them for instructions. Ultimately, whether it was Bobby, three random kids, Jeffrey Daniel, Cooley and Casper, or just old Cab Calloway films, regardless of what inspired Michael, he truly took it to another level.
I was the one that taught Michael how to do it.
Wow. Can you tell me that story? I somehow didn't know that.
It was New Edition, and we were invited over to Michael Jackson's house. We was all just dancing in this big room with mirrors, and he saw me do it. We was popping. He was watching us pop, and he saw me do the moonwalk, and he was just like, you know, what is that? And I did it again, and he just watched it, and he just started doing it.
Wow. So what did you think when Motown 25 came on TV and all of a sudden everyone was doing it?
I thought it was great. That was greatness at its finest. He made it look better than I did. he took it and perfected it.
Wow. So where did you see it for the first time?
I saw it down south. This kid down south in Alabama had put some sand on the ground and just started sliding back, and it was just like I was so in awe of him doing that. I had to ask him how is he doing it, and he showed me, and I brought it back up to the north and just started, you know, battling people and using that signature move.
Okay, so at the time you started really performing, there were a lot of groups in the Boston area, stuff like Prince Charles and the City Beat Band. The Superiors. Who was your biggest competition?
None of them. I didn't have competition. It wasn't about competition for me. It was about whoever wanted to battle. If you wanted to battle me, then you had better come prepared.
Okay. Were any of those groups, did you model yourself after any particular aspects of any of them?
No. I basically modeled myself after James Brown, Rick James, Michael Jackson, and Stevie Wonder. I took those three and tried to become that. Mm-hmm. And a little bit of Prince, you know. I won't lie, Prince was, he added the sexiness to what I do. I took a little bit of Prince and a little bit of Michael, a little bit of James, a little bit of Rick, and you have Bobby Brown.
So when New Edition was starting out, your then manager Maurice, he and his brothers were in a group called the Johnson Crew.
can hear more about the Johnson Crew in our episode 208 interview with Tommy Boy's Tom Silverman. For now, all you need to know is that the Maurice mentioned here is the famed Maurice Starr.
And sort of this whole sound that some people call Boston funk was getting started. Was that something you were aware of at the time?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, definitely. The Johnson Crew, you know, they had Pac-Man, Look Out. I believe that was their song. But anyway, Maurice was, you know, he was the music man in the city, you know. And I mean, I was just a dancer and slash wannabe singer, but yeah, they had the music, you know, and they had a lot of songs that that, you know, played over the airwaves, and you know, we would dance to, and you know, they was just a well known force in the music industry, in the music culture of Massachusetts, of Roxbury.
Yeah, and actually, early in New Edition's career, you got to work with Arthur Baker a little bit.
Debut album, 1983's Candy Girl, was released on Streetwise Records, the label run by dance music legend Arthur Baker, who had produced Afrika Bambaataa's seminal track Planet Rock the previous year. Baker also produced and mixed two tracks, had both co-producer and executive producer credits, programmed drums, and played keyboards.
What was that like?
Yeah. Arthur Baker was interesting because, you know, I knew that he was, you know, hip-hop. You know, he was all about hip-hop. And I couldn't wait to, you know, just work with somebody from the genre of New York's hip hop. And that was just a great time.
Amazing. So I was curious about something to jump around just a little bit. I saw some footage of the 1987 Boston Music Awards where you performed, I think it was Girlfriend, and it was just no one was feeling it.
Can anybody talk in here? Anybody talking here? Say it one more time, like this. Let's go. Say la 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 la. I guess can't no one say this big room of all musicians, music lovers, and ain't no one singing with me. I'm getting upset. I'm getting upset. You gonna say it for me? You gotta say it.
And then 2 years later, you come back, and it's you're a conquering hero. What were you thinking when you stepped on stage in '89? Were you thinking about your performance 2 years before?
No. I just, you know, I try to work on my craft, you know, constantly to become better, to be better. You know, I work on myself just the same way. So just working on my craft, I don't look at what happened in the past. I don't look at, you know, the mistakes or the downs. I look up.
Okay. And we had definitely talked to some big New Edition fans going into this, and one of them wanted to know, you know, everyone in the group except you is credited as a writer on the song School. What was the story with that?
I don't know. I really don't know.
That's fair. But, you know, I was reading about the first time you guys were on Soul Train, and you guys called the dancer Ski Carr up on stage.
It's their latest single on the Streetwise label entitled Candy Girl, and they are New Edition.
Ski Lee Carr was a regular fixture on Soul Train and was a crowd favorite. We'll have a link in the show notes to the video of New Edition's 1983 performance of Candy Girl, where they call Carr up on stage.
What do you remember about that?
Oh man, we didn't know what his name was. So when we got there, we used to call him George. We used to call him George before we met him because he wore a suit. So we called our suits Georges. We saw when we wore suits, we had on our George.
Was that after named after any particular person?
We thought it was Ski.
Mm-hmm.
Ski was George. We used to call him George because, you know, we didn't know his name. And he used to always wear suits. So we would call our suits George. And when we got to Soul Train, it was like, Tickle George. And we finally met him. He told us his name. And we was like, oh, man, his name is not George. His name is Ski. Lusky? And it was just funny, man. And he's been a big, big, big supporter of New Edition since day one. I mean, as soon as we met him, he's become basically like the New Edition mascot of our careers. He's been the one person that we looked up to that basically gave us the energy when we didn't have energy. We can watch Soul Train and watch laugh our asses off.
So last year on our show, actually, we had Nice and Smooth on. And so your old friend Smooth B remembered, you know, how he first hooked up with you and started working with you.
Walking down the street, walking down 7th Avenue, I stop in this pizza shop. I look across the street, I see Mixmaster Ice standing on the corner. It was a trip. But it was on the corner of the Omni Hotel. So when I come out, oh, yo, Max. He looked like a Smooth. He's like, yo, come here, man. I come across the street. I said, yo, what's up? He said, what you doing down here? I said, I'm a messenger, man. I told you. He's like, ah. So we laugh, and he's like, yo, that's crazy. So I said, what you doing? He said, I'm waiting for Bobby Brown, man. He's like, yeah, you know, from New Edition, he left the group. And I was like, yeah, all right, I got you. And Bobby walks out of the building, out of the hotel. So he goes. So he's introduced us. He's like, yo, because they would categorize you by your borough. Yo, he a rapper from the Bronx. You know, that's what he told me. He said, yo, he a rapper from the Bronx, man. Like that, right? So Bobby was like, what? Eh? Bring him to the studio. Like that. So then, so now I'm just standing there, like, I'm taking all this, and he goes, bring him to the studio. So he said, yo, you want to come to the studio? I said, I'm on the clock, man. I was like, dude, I'm on the clock, man, you know? So long story short, he said, all right, look, I'm staying in the Omni, boom, 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 boom. You need to come by, man. Come check me out. So I said, I'll come see you later on. I went by the hotel and everything. And then Mixmaster, everybody was there. But it was so.
What's your side of that story? What do you remember about first hooking up with him?
I just remember we was walking down the street in New York City, and I saw this cat, you know, running across. He ran across the street and introduced himself, and, you know, we just kicked it from there. It was just, you know, it was a chemistry that we had together, a bond, a friendship that, you know, it could never be broken. Smooth is my boy and forever will be my friend. It's strange that you asked that question because yesterday I take this television show. It was on air yesterday, actually. It's called Boy Band.
Boy Band, but let's go! Yeah, my girl's like candy, a candy treat. She knocks me high up off my feet. She's so fine as can be. I got B round right to the left of me. Like.
And this guy came over that knows Smooth B and mentioned Smooth B to me yesterday. And it's just incredible that you mentioned him just now.
Yeah, and you know, you guys worked together on King of Stage. You know, there's a lot of rapping on that album, you know, more than I remembered when I went back and listened to it.
What could she have in store?
The girl next door, her very essence, her presence, I do adore. And being this close is driving me wild. I love her personality, her style, her smile. My life is bright once more again. Our lives are hot, our souls will blend. I love that girl more than all the world. She's like priceless diamonds, cultured pearls.
How'd people react to that at the time?
I don't know. King of Stage was my first album, of course, and it was all about everything that I wanted to do that I couldn't do with New Edition. And that was the great part. you know, that I was able to have the freedom to do what I wanted to do. Not knowing that, you know, the next one would be the big one. But I was grateful for the success of Center Stage because it gave me a number one record and it allowed me to keep recording. And it just gave me an end to the industry, you know, as far as the solo artist is concerned.
Right. That album, you kind of worked with a slightly older generation of people, a kind of Larry Blackman and Bernard Wright and people who were, you know, a little older.
Larry Blackman, who produced three songs on King of Stage, is best known for being the lead singer of Cameo. Bernard Wright, who played keyboards on Bobby's song Baby, I Want to Tell You Something, recorded with tons of acts starting in the late 1970s, including Miles Davis, Rick James, and Dougie Fresh. He also put out four solo albums, including the 1981 classic Nard, which was released when he was only 18.
All the rides are 50 cents, so take those ladies, all you just haven't had this much fun anywhere.
What was that like, kind of working with that sort of older generation of R&B artists?
That was great, you know? I just wanted to do music, you know? I just wanted to do good music that I liked. And working with those folks, man, I'll never forget it. The times with Larry Blackman when, you know, he wanted me to wear that red cup on in my video and I was, no, that's not going to happen. I'll wear the tights, but I won't wear the red cup. He wanted to kill little Larry Blackman. But I wouldn't have had my own image if I wore that cup. If I wore that cup, I wouldn't be here today.
Right. And so, you know, the album did okay, but it wasn't, you know, the giant hit that the next record would be. Do you think that the fact that it, you know, didn't, that it wasn't a sort of bang-up hit gave you the creative freedom to bring in the next round of producers, the younger producers, and kind of go with your own sound for the next record?
I think so. You know, and it gave me courage to just try to do my own stuff. To try to work with, you know, the Teddy Rileys and, L.A. and Babyfaces. You know, it gave me that charge to keep going. It gave me the spirit and the feeling, you know, to try harder and not give up on myself.
Mm-hmm. And were you thinking at the time when you were making Don't Be Cruel of I'm going to cross over into pop? Was that even sort of terms you were thinking about?
No, not at all. No, not at all. I've always been a R&B hip hop type of guy. Crossing over is just, you know, your music becomes popular, you know, and that's all that really happens. Your music, you know, reaches a broader base. And I was just grateful that, you know, so many people bought the album and so many people, you know, accepted me as, you know, the artist that I wanted to become. And I'm just grateful.
Yeah. And, you know, Tenderoni, obviously a huge hit on that record.
Bobby's hit, as he makes it clear in a second, is actually just called Roni.
Do you remember the first time you heard that, you know, Tenderoni or Roni, like just someone saying that term?
No.
It was just kind of always around?
It was just always around, you know, and when Michael said it in a record,
Tenderoni, you got to be sparkly, just sugar fly with me.
It was stamped, you know. My song is called Roni. He said Tenderoni. I didn't say Tenderoni. I said my heart belongs to a Roni.
Your singing on that album too is, especially on the ballads, is a lot more confident than the first record.
I'm so
What do you remember about kind of growing as a vocalist in the process of making that album?
Just performing and wanting to please the crowd and not wanting to get booed.
It's the best motivation.
Working on my craft. Just keep working on your craft. And, you know, you can get better each day if you just continue to work on it.
And that was also a period where you kind of stepped up as a songwriter. What were your contributions to My Prerogative? Did you come up with the lyrics or the concept, the melody? What was your...
I did the bass line and the lyrics. The beats, and me and Aaron Paul wrote the lyrics.
Nice. And I know you are a big hip-hop fan. A story just came out, actually. Large Professor just talked about a time where you at one point wanted to make an album with him and Kool G Rap.
You know, we out there, we go out there, man, Atlanta. We get to the airport, Bobby got all convoy, all these cars. He's the first one in the red coupe and all that. We get in the coupe. He got a box of G-Rap albums right there. He loves the album. He's like, yo, the album's crazy, man. I love y'all. We gonna work. We go in the studio. Like, he like, yo, I got the studio. That's when he had bought the studio in Atlanta. He was basically the man in Atlanta at that time. Like, crazy. So we in the studio. I got like a trunk of records, like a treasure trunk of records that I brought with me. So I'm bringing the records. I got my SP-1200, everything. We go into the studio. Bobby comes in, do a little something on the board. Yo, what's up, y'all? Y'all wanna go to strip club? You know, G-Rap, that's his whole shit. Hell yeah, fuck that shit. All right, yo, we come back, man. We work again, man. Go to the strip club that night and never come back to the studio next.
We'll have a link to the rest of the Large Professor interview in the show notes.
What do you remember about that? What did you kind of want it to sound like?
Just the rap side of it. Kool G Rap was a good friend, and you know, I used to always emulate him. You know, with his lisp, and just we hung out so much in New York City when I used to, you know, be out there and live there for a while. It was just, you know, we was gonna just do music together. And we found some time, but, you know, not the time that we needed to, you know, really push it and put it out.
Mm-hmm. I was amazed, looking back at your career, between 88 and 90, let's say, you were on tour almost nonstop. First on the Heartbreak Tour, then on your own world tour. What was that period like? Was that, and especially being on tour with New Edition after you had left the group?
In 1988, Bobby was on the Heartbreak Tour as a solo act, along with Albie Shore and his former group New Edition, which he had left 2 years before.
Was it tense? Was it crazy? What do you remember about that period?
It was kind of crazy, but at the same time, it was a lot of fun because, of course, we all love performing. All of New Edition love performing. And it was just, you know, it was great. It was a great time. All that time, my younger years was all great. I mean, it was icing on the cake for what we wanted to accomplish in life. You know, we got a chance to tour together. We didn't necessarily, wasn't on stage together, but we were touring. You know, we were performing for the people, and the girls were screaming, you know, and that's what we got into this for.
Yeah. And, you know, I used to live in Boston, and I talked to some people who used to live there, so I have one or two kind of Boston-specific questions. Who were Cornell Brown and Duane Omar, and what kind of influence did they have on your early career?
Go ahead, baby.
Yeah.
Cornell Brown ran Bosstown Records, a Boston-based label that put out a handful of records in the early 90s. The song Bounce It's Your Birthday by The Incredible Crew, a group led by his young son Ignacio, which Brown wrote, produced, engineered, and sang backup on, was a big local hit. Dwayne Omar, who worked with Brown before and during the Bosstown era, would produce for New Edition's Ralph Tresvant in the early 90s.
They didn't have any of mine. Mm-hmm. I believe they had an influence with Ralph Tresvant. They worked with Ralph quite a bit.
Gotcha. And in the My Secret video, it's a great video, but you guys are hanging out with the Lakers. What's up with five Boston guys hanging out with the Lakers?
Oh, man, that's just a video. We're die-hard Boston fans, trust me.
How did that come about? Why did you try to do it with the Celtics?
No. We was just in L.A., you know, and the director of the video happened to get us a shot with the Lakers, you know. We had went to a Laker game, but we was in Los Angeles at the time, so no, we wasn't trying to make it out to look like that we were Laker fans or anything like that, because you know, we wear Boston gear all day, all night.
Yeah, you catch any grief back home after that came out?
Yes, we did.
I bet. One other Boston question. The Don't Be Cruel video, I think, was shot somewhere in the city. Do you remember exactly where?
No, Don't Be Cruel video was shot in Los Angeles also.
Oh, okay. Shows what I know. All right. I had heard that it was shot somewhere in Boston. So someone else you worked early with your career, we talk about a lot of hip-hop on here, it was Mixmaster Ice. How did that come about?
I was on tour with UTFO was on tour with me when the King of Stage album. And of course they're good friends also. Knowing Houdini and UTFO and Mixmaster Ice and all of them. Those were just, you know, my younger days, and you know, we were just good friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the way he raps. I love the way all of them rap.
Did you ever think about making just a hip hop record yourself, just you rhyming back during that period, or do you still?
Yeah. It's still my dream.
We got to hear it. You know, On Our Own has always been one of my favorite songs of yours, and the rap especially.
Too hot to handle, too cold to hold. They called the Ghostbusters and the End Control. Had a throwing party for a bunch of children. Well, all the while, the slime was under the building. So they packed up, regrouped, got a grip, came equipped, grabbed their proton packs on the back, and they split. Found out about Beagle, the master of evil. Try to battle my boys.
Who wrote the rap for that? And
On Our Own. I believe I did. I think it was Off the Head, though. You know, I don't think it was actually written.
Really?
Yeah.
Nice. The opening line of it, the too hot to handle, too cold to hold, that's kind of something that, you know, it's a line that's been around hip-hop for a while.
I was too hot to handle, too cold to hold. Because
too hot to handle, too cold to hold. Bolder than bad, I'm bad in the bowl. I'm on the mic.
Do you remember where that came from? Or where you might have heard it?
I don't remember. It's just, you know, that's why I believe it was Off the Head, you know.
And so the Bobby album, after all this, had such an incredible, huge crew of people involved in it. L.A. Reid and Babyface and Teddy Riley kind of all working together. How did that line up? How'd that happen?
Well, we was all out to make a better album than Don't Be Cruel. All of the producers, myself, we was aiming to make an incredible album. We wanted a thriller. And, you know, we fell short, but we didn't fall as short as, you know, some others, you know, that tried to make a thriller. It was a great album. This is the 25th year of the Bobby album. So, you know, I'm looking forward to, you know, probably repackaging it and putting it out again.
Excellent. And, you know, what can fans expect to see from you at the Rochester Music Festival performance?
Oh, just pure love and energy and excitement. I'm so excited to get there. I'm so excited to just be in Rochester again. Anywhere upstate, just New York City, period, is my kind of town. So I just can't wait to get there and see the crowd and see the people and give them all the energy and absorb all the energy that they give back to me.
And kind of one more obscure question. There was a rapper, sort of, I believe, from your neighborhood in the early 90s called Tam Tam, who briefly had a record deal.
I'm gonna do it, 'cause there's really nothing to expect.
shake my thing. So excuse yourself, let me have the floor so I can give you a taste of what you came here for. Cause no matter where you look, I know you won't find another new diverse.
Did you have anything to do with that? I heard you may have.
Yeah, I remember. I vaguely remember, but that was so long ago. You know, my mind is foggy.
Fair enough. Real quick, one kind of final thing. You know, as you were making Don't Be Cruel, right around maybe a year or two before, there was another pop star, also a child star, who kind of came out and got control over her image with an album literally called Control.
This is a story about control. My control. Control of what I say, control of what I do. And this time I'm gonna do it my way. I hope you enjoy this as much as I do.
Was Control kind of a inspiration for you as you were trying to step out with Don't Be Cruel?
No, not at all. Control was Control, but my prerogative and Don't Be Cruel for me was, you know, just my efforts to become a bigger artist, to become a better artist. I was singing a lot better. I was, you know, I believe, you know, just doing my thing a lot better. So, no, I don't think it influenced me. It was a great record. But no, she probably influenced me in other ways.
Well, we'll have to leave that up to the sequel. Bobby, thank you so much for your time.
Well, I appreciate you.
I'm just the right age that the hits from Don't Be Cruel were absolutely inescapable for me as they were hitting the radio. But one thing I didn't know at the time was Bobby Brown's love of hip-hop. I'm glad that comes through in the show. From Grandmaster Flash and Mixmaster Ice to Greg Nice and Kool G Rap, Bobby, or Flash B, I should say, has long been a fan and strong supporter of hip-hop. And as a former Bostonian myself, I was thrilled to get a chance to explore the city's often overlooked musical history with one of its prime movers. The Cypher will be on our usual summer schedule for July and August, bringing you shows every other week. So join us in 2 weeks on September 11th when we talk to Houston rap legend Trey the Truth. To make sure you hear each episode of The Cypher as soon as it comes out, subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your podcast app of choice. That's a good opportunity to check out our back catalog. If you like this episode, you should listen to our talk with Bobby's old friend Greg Nice and his partner Smooth B on episode 158. Whatever you use to listen to the show, Apple's podcast, Google Play, seriously whatever, go now and give us a rating and a review. It helps us bring more fans and attention to the show. And you can really help us by becoming a patron. Visit us at patreon.com/thecyphershow and sign up. Bringing you a weekly show takes at least 20 hours a week, and we could really use the support. If even 20% of you gave just a buck a month, Sean might actually be able to pay off his Blockbuster fees for that overdue copy of Ghostbusters 2. As an added bonus for our patrons, every month we share bonus audio that we get from our guests, either while talking to them after the main interview is over, or sometimes when they give us some extra special material. Join us by the end of August to have access to September's file. Previous months have included unreleased music from the likes of Wu-Tang and Chuck D. If you want to talk to us about the show, visit us on social media. We're at The Cypher Show on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Let us know what you thought of this episode and who you'd like to see on the show in the future. More information about anything related to the podcast, playlists, our complete archives, and more can be found for free at thecyphershow.com. The Cypher is created and written by Sean Sotero.
Performing for the people.
The show is produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
I was really quick as a dancer.
Our music is by 42 Ghosts.
We didn't know what his name was.
Our web guru is Aaron Young.
Added the sexiness to.
Audio assistance by Rob Van Vranken.
I used to always emulate him.
Special audio consulting by Florence Barrow Adams.
And working with those folks, man, I'd never forget it.
Thank you to Patreon supporter Carrie Denver.
I was singing a lot better.
Extra thanks to Dart Adams for the insight about Boston.
It was all about everything that I wanted to do.
We'll see you next time around on The Cypher.